Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Gadim Slonkomer, the host of this channel. And today I'm here with Dr. Michael Burley to talk about his book, Radical Pluralist Philosophy of Religion, Cross-Cultural, Multi-Religious, and Interdisciplinary. Now, I think religious pluralism is something which is very much talked about in today's context, and also philosophically, Dr. Michael tries to look at this pluralist philosophy of religion and tries to understand this philosophy of religion, also give a framework which he calls as the radical pluralist philosophy of religion. So to dig deeper into this, let's straight away go to the author himself. So Dr. Michael, can you tell us something about yourself?
Yes, I can. Thank you very much, Tiatsemu, for having me on the podcast. Yes, I mean, I work at the University of Leeds in the north of England. I'm in the School of Philosophy, Religion and History of Science. And currently, I am one of three deputy heads of that school. And I'm an associate professor of religion and philosophy. So philosophy of religion is very central to my teaching and research. I've been at the University of Leeds since 2005, so quite a while now. And I teach not only philosophy of religion, but also in the area of South Asian religions, sort of broadly speaking, especially Hindu and Buddhist traditions. I teach material on those topics. And before I came to Leeds, I did a PhD at the University of Bristol, and that was in Indian philosophy. I was specializing in Sankhya and yoga philosophy. And that PhD ended up being turned into a monograph, a book called Classical Sankhya and Yoga, an Indian Metaphysics of Experience, which came out in 2007. Since then, I've published a few more books. And I mean, I don't know how far back into my past you want me to go, but I could at least say that some of my background training is in both sociology and philosophy. And when I say philosophy, I mean both Western philosophy in analytic and continental traditions, and also Indian philosophy. As I say, my PhD at Bristol was on Indian philosophy. So I have a sort of quite a varied academic past, and up to the present, I think it's helped me in seeing the topics that I research from different disciplinary perspectives. And so the term interdisciplinary in the subtitle of the book that we're discussing is very important, because I draw upon sociological, anthropological, and literary and other sources in my research.
Yeah, quite interesting. And you say that you have background in studying Indian philosophy and also in sociology and all. So I'm also interested to know how this book came together as a pluralist philosophy of religion, or looking at religious pluralism. Yeah.
Yes, well, for several years now, I have been among a number of people practicing philosophy of religion in the sort of Western context. who have become increasingly dissatisfied with the narrowness in the scope and perhaps certain limitations in the methodology of the way that Western philosophy of religion has been practiced. So I've been working, you know, I'm not unique in this, but I've been working on ways of trying to expand the philosophy of religion, both in terms of the range of religious traditions that are discussed, the variety of religious phenomena that are discussed within sort of philosophical terms, and also thinking about methodology, thinking about how one can develop, especially in my case, you know, more interdisciplinary ways of working. And so these interests of mine have manifested in various publications over the years. And so that the book that of mine before this one, before A Radical Pluralist Philosophy of Religion, was on the topic of reincarnation. It's called Rebirth and the Stream of Life, a philosophical study of reincarnation, karma, and ethics. And that too, I sort of situated it disciplinarily within the philosophy of religion, but it was trying to do something a little bit different from the usual, you know, exploring aspects of reincarnation beliefs across multiple different religious and cultural traditions. And so that was one of my more significant contributions to this expansion of the philosophy of religion. And then subsequent to that, I continued working on a number of articles in different areas of philosophy of religion, exploring ways of drawing upon ethnographic material and also literary material or narrative sources. And so I published a number of articles on those themes, and they had a certain coherence to them, and I eventually sort of reworked them and also added some further material, and that produced the book that came out in 2020, A Radical Pluralist Philosophy of Religion.
That's an interesting background to the book, actually. Yeah. So now when we are talking about religious pluralism, we are looking at the plurality of conceptualizing certain religion, but also at the same time, we're also looking at the historical background, all of those aspects. Now, as a philosopher, someone will look at it from a very philosophical point of view. Now, when we talk about religious pluralism, obviously there are many names, but there are three persons that you talk about here, which is John Hick, John Cobb, and Victoria Harrison. Now, this is where you delve into their work and, you know, do a critical overview of their work. So can you, in short, tell us what their, you know, solution to the religious pluralism is, and how their solution might not really come up to the way how religious pluralism might be conceptualized?
Yes, it's a big topic, so I'll try my best to be brief on it. I selected in the so the part one of the book is on critique and methodology, and the chapter that you're referring to is the sort of critique component. And so I wanted to contrast my own position and my own approach to some existing ones, and the ones that I selected, as you say, were those versions of religious pluralism that have been presented by John Hick, John Cobb, and Victoria Harrison. And so these are, of course, are not the only contributors to this area of discussion, but they're relatively representative. John Hick has been a very significant figure, and I have a lot of admiration for his work, for the way that he broadened out the range of religious traditions that are discussed and considered within the philosophy of religion. But ultimately, his approach to religious pluralism, I find unsatisfactory because of the extent to which he, what I describe as sort of homogenizing the multiplicity of religious traditions. He aims he makes the claim that at least all what he calls the great world traditions are directed towards the same metaphysical principle, which he calls the real. And I suppose in principle there's nothing wrong with making that claim, but I think it runs the risk of overlooking the differences, you know, the important distinctions that need to be made between different religious traditions. And another thing that it does is it sort of sidelines, it marginalizes smaller traditions, especially what we might call indigenous religious traditions. They kind of get left out of the whole picture. So those are two things that I want to try to overcome in my own approach. I don't want to be homogenizing. I don't want to be essentializing or oversimplifying, and nor do I want to be leaving out those smaller religious traditions within the compass of my work. John Cobb, he is a little bit more what I might say, pluralistic, insofar as in his approach, he allows for different aspects of this metaphysical principle that supposedly all the great traditions are directed towards. He also has an aspiration to promote a kind of harmony between different religions. And I have, of course, I mean, it'd be crazy to have any aversion to promoting harmony between different religious traditions. But again, the risk of foregrounding and prioritizing that kind of aspiration is that it overlooks important differences between religious traditions. And so my emphasis, and I don't want to say that my approach is I certainly don't want to say that it's the only approach worth pursuing, nor even necessarily is it the best approach. But where its emphasis lies is on trying to bring out, explore differences as well as similarities between traditions, and putting aside any aspiration to try to unite them under one general theory. So again, you know, I think there are certain aspects of John Cobb's approach that are at least out of step with the approach that I pursue. And in the case of Victoria Harrison, her approach is quite different from Hick's approach or that of John Cobb. She calls her approach it's a internal realist approach. So it's an internal realist pluralist approach. And the crucial thing about it, I mean, she draws upon the work of Hilary Putnam in developing it. And the crucial thing about it is that she claims that not necessarily individual religions, but what she calls faith stances, so particular religious perspectives, are incommensurable with one another. They do stand radically distinct from one another. So in a way, you know, this would be one way of putting my disagreement with Victoria Harrison. She goes too far in the other direction. You know, I certainly want to acknowledge and admit and pay attention to differences between different religions, different religious perspectives, and so on. But I don't want to claim that they belong to distinct conceptual schemes that somehow interferes with their ability to even understand one another. As I say, I think that's going too far in the other direction. And I could say more about all three of those figures, but that's probably enough to indicate where my disagreement lies.
Yeah, interesting. So, as everyone knows, in every religion, obviously there are inconsumable differences. I mean, which cannot be really brought together, right? So, how do we really understand these differences? In a sense, how does these differences come about, and how do we understand it? And if we are going forward to talking about, let's say, a form of religious tolerance where we live with these kind of differences, then philosophically, how do we really understand these differences, and, you know, how do we really cope with it?
Yes, well, I mean, I think the important thing from my perspective is not to enter the inquiry with assumptions that say all the religions are ultimately directed towards the same metaphysical reality. So a crucial part of the inquiry is to be attentive to both similarities and differences, not to enter the inquiry with broad ranging assumptions about what must be the case. And then, well, I mean, it's no easy matter. As I say, my emphasis is not on necessarily promoting or developing harmonious relationships between the religions. I think that that's an important aspiration to have. But I think that the logically prior piece of research to do is to just come to understand the religions sort of on their own terms in a deeper capacity. And so that's what I'm trying to do. And if there are disagreements between them, then it's important to try to elucidate and clarify what those disagreements are, rather than glossing over them with the aim of somehow pretending that they're ultimately all in harmony with one another. So as I say, so the project of promoting tolerance, respect, religious harmony, and so on, come at a further stage along the way. My own project is, I would say, at a prior stage to that. It's trying to clarify, it's trying to elucidate, it's trying to understand and analyze the religions and the various cultures and perspectives in their own right. And then there are many ways of doing that, and the many ways of doing it I try to exemplify across the various chapters of the book. So no doubt we can go into some of those methods that I deploy.
One of the things that you also point out is the some of the problems with the philosophy of religion and trying to understand religion. See, for me personally, as I look into religion, right, the discourse in terms of philosophy, the discourse of religion is so much dominated by the you know, Judeo-Christian idea of what they call as God or the ultimate reality or the ultimate being and all of those aspects, you know, the meta aspect of it. So when we talk about religion, these questions obviously doesn't escape in a sense. And basically when I work on the traditional religion or any indigenous religions and all, somehow all these questions also pop up, right? Whoa, so what is God in traditional religion? You know, how do we compare it to the Christian idea of God and all of those things? But then I don't see can be compared to what Christian God should be, because it has their framework of trying to understand all of the aspects. So in terms of understanding these things from a philosophical point of view or the philosophy of religion point of view, what are some of the topics that philosophy has in terms of understanding these things?
Well, I think you've put your finger on the one of the main shortcomings of a lot of contemporary mainstream Western philosophy of religion, which is a fixation, an obsession, a sort of single pointed focus on the topic of theism, as it gets called, which is as many listeners may know, is a sort of somewhat abstract term that refers to something like, you know, a belief in a monotheistic God, normally a monotheistic God rather than any other type. And so, yes, there has been a strong emphasis, a strong bias towards considering questions that are relevant to Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. But often it's a little bit worse than that, which is that the concept of theism, because it tries to engage with the idea of belief in God at quite an abstract level, it's not always obvious how the questions that mainstream philosophy of religion engages with actually relate to ordinary people's religious lives. So I think that, you know, that is all part of the critique that has been leveled against mainstream Western philosophy of religion over recent years by other colleagues, including myself. And so what I think also that was hinted at in the way that you posed the question was the way in which, by imposing that sort of Western philosophical paradigm onto other religious traditions, maybe small scale indigenous traditions included, and by sort of trying to shoehorn those traditions into one's own framework of discussion, asking the same traditional questions, but just in relation to those other traditions. So, you know, how does their, as you say, how does their conception of God relate to the conception of God that is prominent within theistic modes of religiosity? That has the danger of doing a conceptual injustice to those traditions that one is purportedly investigating. Now, the solution to sort of overcoming that danger or that risk it's no easy matter. And I don't, you know, my book, I think, is very exploratory, you know, trying to find ways of, to use the phrase that I sort of borrow from some Wittgensteinian philosophers such as D.Z. Phillips, doing conceptual justice to the phenomena, to the traditions under examination. It's hard. One has to, you know, seek out different methods, different approaches, ones that stray outside of the ones that have been pursued by mainstream Western philosophy of religion. And again, another risk here is that that when one does this, sometimes people who are familiar with reading mainstream Western philosophy of religion don't readily recognize what one's doing as falling within the sort of remit, within the scope of philosophy of religion. And again, I draw attention to the subtitle of my book, which is Cross-Cultural, Multi-Religious, Interdisciplinary. So I'm not claiming that it's doing philosophy of religion in the standard way. No, it's trying to do it in a cross-cultural, multi-religious, interdisciplinary way, and exploring, you know, ways of going about that.
Yeah, so in the next section, you talk about examples of how you try to do the radical pluralist philosophy of religion. Now, this is where you also put in the concept of dig description, right? So looking at the three examples, can you point out some of the methodological ways or some of the examples that you have brought out from the three examples that you brought out, right, that to how the radical pluralist philosophy of religion can be exemplified through the three examples that you have given? Can you elaborate that one?
Yes, I mean, I hope throughout the book there are various examples. And so among the sort of methodological tools that I draw upon, thick description is prominent among them. And thick description is it's an interesting concept. It originated in our analytic philosophy. The very term was coined by Gilbert Ryle, a philosopher at Oxford, back in the 1960s. But then it became much better known as a concept and as an approach when it was picked up by anthropologists, primary among them being Clifford Geertz in the early 1970s. And Geertz popularized the notion of thick description, and he developed it in a way that was pertinent to ethnographic forms of research. And I don't use it in a particularly strict way. You know, what I mean by thick description is providing forms of description that are, you know, rich, they're detailed, they're embellished, they're not simplistic, they're not pared down to overly simplified thought experiments, the kinds that that philosophers, including philosophers of religion, often work with. I think that more elaborate, more embellished forms of description can be helpful. They can play a part, and the part that they can play, among others, is familiarizing the reader with perhaps a form of life, an approach to life, different aspects of religiosity that the reader may not have been previously familiar with. Now, you don't familiarize yourself with a tradition that you're not already acquainted with by reading very simplified thought experiments. The way that you do it is by immersing yourself as much as you can within that tradition. Now, the best way of immersing oneself is to actually go and, you know, live among people that that exemplify some particular religious tradition or cultural form of life. And that is what, you know, ethnographers do. So sort of second best, as it were, is to read the work of very accomplished ethnographers and to familiarize oneself with those ways of being, those ways of being human that are presented in the ethnography. So, you know, ethnography is a primary instance of thick description, because it brings out different aspects of a culture, including important religious aspects. Another form of thick description, which is a way in which I'm using the term perhaps in a slightly extended sense, is a work of narrative. It could be a work of narrative fiction, and that would include novels or theatrical plays or even films. Now, I don't explore many of those in this particular book. That's a project that is ongoing for me, but I do give some examples. So in chapter 3, where I discuss narrative fiction, I give the example of the Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov, a great classic novel, and how he explores different perspectives on religion through that novel, including a very committed Orthodox Christian perspective on the one hand, and a sort of radical atheistic perspective on the other, and other, you know, different kinds of perspectives in between. And also at greater length explore Wole Soyenka's play, Death and the King's Horseman. And so that's a little bit more novel on my part, a little bit more original on my part, because Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov has been discussed by other philosophers of religion to some extent. Whereas Death and the King's Horseman, I think, is a remarkable work of theatre by Wole Soyenka. And, you know, too many themes within it to go into detail now. But what I try to bring out is the way in which a play such as that can present to us, whether it be on the stage or whether we're reading it in written form, can present to us different religious and indeed non-religious perspectives embodied in the characters that are, you know, engaging with each other in the action of the play. And I think Death and the King's Horseman does that to a very great extent, and through my discussion of it, I try to exemplify how we can, as philosophers of religion, not only draw upon, say, works of narrative fiction of that sort, but also how the works themselves, in this case a play, can be understood as sort of doing a kind of philosophy themselves, doing a kind of pluralistic philosophizing, simply by placing different perspectives in juxtaposition with one another.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Quite interesting as to how you conceptualize this very idea of thick description in that sense, and when you go into the narratives or narrative forms and all. Now, one of the examples that you bring out is the Buddhist idea of compassion. Now, how does this Buddhist idea of compassion, you know, argue towards this radical pluralist philosophy of religion? Yeah.
Well, one of the sort of general principles, I suppose we could say, that I am applying in my work, I've hinted at it strongly already, is a resistance to oversimplify and to homogenize, whether it be concepts or traditions. And so what I'm picking up on in the chapter on the Buddhist concepts or conception of compassion is that compassion can mean many different things. You know, the term compassion or its sort of linguistic equivalents in different indigenous Buddhist languages can mean different things in different contexts. It can mean different things to different Buddhist traditions. And also more broadly, it can mean different things in other religious traditions too. So my foil, you know, what I'm arguing against in that chapter is the sort of claim that says somewhat glibly, either compassion is at the heart of all religious traditions, compassion is the essential feature of Buddhism, you know, something like that. And people do say that. People have said things along those lines. And I give a few examples of people saying something pretty comparable to that. Now, I don't want to argue that I don't want to claim that compassion is not extremely important within Buddhist traditions and other traditions too. All I want to claim is that we need to be careful about assuming that we already know what compassion amounts to in any religious tradition or set of traditions before actually looking carefully at what its implications are. And so I try to, you know, bring out within the chapter I talk about different stories and different traditions of Buddhism in which the concept of compassion seems to amount to different things, or at least it has different implications for how one acts and how one and the sort of attitudes one adopts towards one's own life and towards others. I mean, I could give a couple of examples. So one of the stories I talk about is the Vaisantara Jataka, the birth narrative of one of the Buddha's previous lives when he was Prince Vaisantara, and this story is claimed within Buddhist traditions to illustrate primarily the virtue of generosity, we might say, but as also, you know, the idea of compassion is built into it too. And yet the way that those virtues are exhibited in the story are by Vaisantara relinquishing attachments to his worldly possessions and indeed his worldly relationships to such an extent that he's willing to give his two children away to become servants or slaves of the person to whom he gives them. So it's a very stark, it's a very striking, it's a very emotionally engaging story that has a prominent place within certain Buddhist traditions. And yet, you know, the way that it's exemplifying, illustrating that particular virtue, whether we call it generosity or compassion or a combination of both, is one that we might find, from a certain perspective, quite ethically challenging, let's say. And then within other traditions, we find within other Buddhist traditions, we find the concept of what gets translated as skillful means, you know, upaya, kaushalya. And this is a notion that opens up, you know, the interpretation of acts, whether they be regarded as sort of ethical acts or other kinds of behavior, to very wide interpretations. And so there's a story in which, again, it's a story about one of the Buddha's previous lives. It is claimed that in order to prevent a thief, a murderous thief, from engaging in murder upon a ship, that the Buddha undertook to kill that thief. It was perhaps a hard decision to make, but it's decided to commit an act of murder himself. And yet it was committed out of compassion, of course, compassion not only for the thief himself to prevent him from committing any heinous crimes, but also compassion for the other people on board the ship. So again, it's another very complex story illustrating the notion of compassion, but in a striking way, in a way that we might find, you know, surprising. So it's claimed that certain acts of deliberate murder can themselves be compassionate. And this is what I'm doing in the chapter. I'm sort of exploring these stories. I'm exploring other aspects of Buddhist traditions in order to show that compassion can come in very different forms. And so we simply shouldn't assume that we know what it means. We know what it amounts to in every case.
Yeah, interesting. Now, again, you dedicate the next two chapters on bringing two more different examples in terms of mortuary practice, sacrifices, and the human body and all of those aspects. But I want to go into the chapter where you brought out animism as a case study in trying to understand this, or bring out this radical pluralist philosophy of religions, right? So how do you bring in animism here, and how does it exemplify the very radicalist philosophy of religion? Yeah.
Yes, thanks. So in chapter 7, I explore the concept of animism. I have a couple of purposes in that chapter. So one purpose, one sort of overarching purpose is to find some ways of engaging with aspects of indigenous religions in relation to philosophy of religion. So I talk about previous attempts that some philosophers of religion have made to discuss indigenous religions, and they haven't, they've tended to not do it in a very thorough way. And it's another, it's another difficulty. It's a difficulty for anyone that's sort of familiar with the form of philosophy of religion that goes on within mainstream Western academic contexts to know what to say, what can usefully be said about small scale indigenous religious traditions. So that's the sort of overarching theme. And then within that context of the chapter, I take the concept of animism as one that lends itself to some interesting, I think, sort of philosophical analysis and discussion. Not least because, again, as some listeners may be aware, the concept of animism has sort of been revived. It's undergone a revival. So back in the 19th century, when it was first used by anthropologists, especially Edward Tylor, to denote not only sort of aspects of religion, but actually something that was very central to religion. Edward Tylor defined animism in terms of a belief in spiritual beings, and he thought that that was absolutely central to religion as a whole. So there was a sense in which, for Tylor, animism was the very heart of religion. But over time, both by Tylor himself and by others, the term animism became more associated with the forms of religion that one finds in small-scale societies. And it may be applied to the belief that plants, animals, various other features of the natural environment are either sentient, and that's not such a controversial claim in the case of animals, of course, but may also it may also imply that they have a certain person, they have certain personal features or spiritual features, and are indeed spiritual beings of certain types. And and so again, as anthropology developed, as this term animism came to be used more prominently, it came to be almost synonymous with particular types of small scale indigenous religion. And it was thought later on, by about the mid 20th century, it was thought to be a somewhat derogatory term. It was thought to be a little dismissive of those traditions. To say that something was animistic was a way of saying, it's a little bit kooky or peculiar. It's not very rationally grounded. And so, understandably, anthropologists didn't want to be saying that about their subject, the people and cultures that they were studying. And so the term animism dropped out of favor. But more recently, towards the very end of the 20th century and into the current century, the 21st century, the term has been revived, and there's even this concept of new animism, which distinguishes itself from the so-called old animism by emphasizing different aspects of the religions, both of small-scale indigenous societies and of others. Among the things that are emphasized are the relationality, seeing oneself in relation to different features of the environment and different animals and the whole ecosystem, and thinking of that as an interconnected sort of network of whether we just call them sentient beings or personal beings. But certainly some new animists have claimed that sort of personhood is attributed to animals, plants, and indeed some mineral entities. So philosophically, this is an interesting area to discuss, and how I try to discuss it is to pick up on some examples of places where philosophers of religion and anthropologists have discussed the concept of animism. And so I make these distinctions between old animism, new animism, talk about the various meanings of various ways in which the term new animism is being used. And within that context, I distinguish between sort of literalistic ways of understanding animistic talk on the one hand and metaphorical ways on the other. And I endeavor to make conceptual space for a third possibility, which is that when, say, personhood or sentience is attributed to the earth, or to an area of land, it's not essential, it's not necessary to conceive of that either in reductive metaphorical terms as sort of being merely metaphorical, as we might say, but nor is it necessary to think of it in overly literalistic terms as meaning that the land in this case has sentience or personhood in exactly the same way as a human being might. Rather, what, you know, the third possibility is that this way of talking, this way of relating to the earth, sort of opens up an alternative way of conceiving of the earth, a way that exhibits a profound kind of respect careful and considerate treatment of the earth, and that gets articulated through the language in a way that can be reduced neither to a pure literalism nor to a merely metaphorical way of talking. That's the idea. That's one of the key ideas that I'm exploring in that chapter.
Now, as I'm listening to you and as I've been reading your work, I kind of see the kind of suggestion that you are putting in the radical pluralist philosophy of religion is more like saying, like, to the philosophers as to go beyond just doing, you know, the armchair philosophy or something like that. Is it something that you're suggesting in a sense of, like, to the philosophers or in terms of philosophical thinking on the pluralist aspect of religion, that is it you are telling them to do, you know, philosophy, but also at the same time philosophy through fieldwork in a sense?
I'm certainly not telling anyone that they ought to engage in philosophical field work, but it is an interest of mine, and I've done that to a very limited extent myself. But I think it's something that I would very much like to explore further in the future. So I'll give you the example in the book that draws upon some of my field work, and I hope it's not too grandiose a claim to call it philosophical field work, but it is field work that was intended to inform my understanding of a particular religious festival as it happens. So in chapter 6 of the book, the central example that I'm using in order to explicate certain ideas about two main themes, one of which is what gets called divine possession, and another of which is animal sacrifice. So these are two dimensions, two aspects of a lot of ritual activity, not only in the particular religious context that I'm discussing in the chapter, but elsewhere as well. And yet, you know, it's far from easy to know how philosophers of religion, whether it be in the sort of analytic tradition or any style of Western philosophy, how they're going to, you know, engage with those forms of practice. Well, in order to educate myself more about the themes of animal sacrifice and divine possession in religious ritual, I travelled to Assam. And I visited the Karmakya temple, which is just north of Guwahati, the capital of Assam, in 2017, and I spent time investigating a particular festival, which goes by various names, sometimes Manasar Puja, or the Diodani Utsav, the Diodani Festival. But what's absolutely central to this festival is the performance of a sort of ritualized, vigorous dancing performed by somewhere between 16 and 20, 21 male dancers, of whom it is claimed that they are possessed by various deities from within the Hindu pantheon, broadly speaking. And a number of these deities that it is claimed inhabit the bodies of these dancers for the duration of the festival are fierce, ferocious goddesses. And so a number of these dancers sort of act out fierce and ferocious gestures within the sort of dance that they're performing, and they're wielding certain kinds of weapon. In fact, there's one of these dancers depicted on the front cover of my book. He's jumping in the air, he has a sword in one hand, and he has quite a stern expression on his face, and he is embodying a deity of a ferocious kind. So we've got the theme of divine possession there, and the animal sacrifice is a routine practice at the Karmakya temple, and it intensifies during certain festival periods, including during the 3 days of this particular festival to which I'm referring. And many of the animals that are beheaded are young male goats, and also a lot of pigeons are sacrificed, and some other animals, other types of animal as well. And so the themes of blood and of sacrificial practices are combined with these elements of divine possession into a very vigorous, vibrant festival atmosphere, with drumming and cymbals clashing. And I could not have really got the full sense of that festival if I hadn't been there myself. So I made the effort to sort of visit the temple before and after the festival, and I spent the whole duration of the festival present there within the temple complex, observing what was going on, absorbing the atmosphere, and taking quite extensive notes while I was there. So although I'm not a trained anthropologist, I've never carried out any extensive ethnography, and it would be outrageous to refer to what I did there as ethnography. It wasn't as anywhere near as extensive as that, but it was a kind of field work, and I hope that I've been able to bring some of the information that I gleaned from that experience into my articulation of the what I might call the sort of phenomenology of the festival that I try to explore and express in the chapter. And whether readers will recognize it as legitimately philosophical is another matter. But I hope that it does help to inform readers who are not already familiar with that kind of festival experience of something about what it's like to be there.
In the beginning, I also mentioned about how the study of the philosophy of religion is dominated by this, very Abrahamic conception of what God is and all of those divisions. Now, when you look at traditional religion or indigenous religion, as we call it, their philosophical aspect is yet to come to the forefront into the discussion in the arena of the discussion of philosophy of religion, right? Worldly arena. So obviously, it will take some time for that philosophy to come up. And that is something which I'm also really interested in trying to formalize or conceptualize this indigenous philosophy of religion, and I think that is something a very interesting aspect. So looking at all of those things now, with this radical pluralist philosophy of religion, one of the things that you're also suggesting is also trying to reimagine how philosophy of religion is done, right? So can you tell us something about how you are trying to reimagine this aspect?
Well, yes, I use that phrase towards the very end of the book, in the final chapter, in the very final section of the final chapter, and it's a way of of me trying to encapsulate what I'm doing throughout the whole of the book. So much of what I've already been saying is, relates to my idea of how philosophy of religion might be reimagined. And I don't want to be, presumptuous about it, and I don't want to be brash in claiming, that somehow what I've done in the book is the way that philosophy of religion ought to go. All I'm doing is inviting my readers, perhaps especially my readers who may engage in philosophy of religion themselves. I'm inviting them to explore, examine, to think about alternative ways of undertaking research and writing in the philosophy of religion. So my reimagining, here, what I've done in this book, give some examples to consider. Do it yourself. Think about other ways that one could expand the scope, the parameters of philosophy of religion. So the ways that I've used in the book include what we've been talking about. So that's drawing upon ethnographic studies. It's also, to a limited extent at least, undertaking a bit of field work myself, and drawing upon literary narrative sources as well, and giving emphasis to thickly described examples, and also giving emphasis to the plurality, seeing where the important differences are, both within and across and among and between different expressions of religion and culture, and seeing where one goes. That's the imaginative project. It's not to be too constrained by the existing routine traditional ways of doing things, but seeing what other possibilities are available.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Mikkel, for that. Is there any other thing that you want to highlight from the book which I might have missed out?
Nothing in particular. I mean, very briefly, because it was skipped over, I'll just mention the topic of one of the chapters that we didn't discuss. You did allude to it quite briefly, but it's chapter 5 on, it's on the theme of cannibalism. And my purpose there is to examine how the very concept of what a person is or what a human being is can shift, can be take on a different complexion, a different aspect in cultures where various practices are performed, including different types of cannibalism. So if you've got a culture within which human beings are among the things that can be eaten without that breaching any particular ethical norms, for example, then that has an important part to play in the very way that human beings are conceptualized. No longer is the distinction between the animal and the human, no longer does that which can be eaten and that which cannot be eaten feature so prominently within that conceptual distinction, but the distinction can be made in other ways. And so I draw upon ethnography from anthropologists who have worked in the Brazilian rainforests, discussing a particular cultural group called the Wari in that chapter. And so they're some of the themes that I explore there. It's another example of how I'm trying to find ways of engaging with small scale indigenous traditional cultural groups in a philosophically interesting way.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for that. So if anyone wants to reach out to you, how do they reach out to you?
They can reach out to me in various ways. I mean, the obvious way would be just to type my name into a search engine, Mikkel Burley, M-I-K-E-L-B-U-R-L-E-Y, and it's very likely that my university profile webpage would come up as one of the top items in such a search. So I have a webpage on the University of Leeds website, and that gives information. It gives my email address and my details about some of my publications and so on. I also have a academia.edu webpage, and so that would probably come up in a similar search. And if somebody has an academia.edu account, they could download some sort of preprints of my publications from that website. So they're probably the two most obvious ways of finding more about my work.
So what are you currently working on, or is there any other exciting project that is coming up?
Yes, I mean, I am working on some projects, slightly too many to mention all of them, but the main one is, and it's an extension of the book that we've been talking about. It's kind of taking this further. I'm trying to develop the area of what I call narrative philosophy of religion in greater detail. So I've had some sort of articles published on this theme already, and there's the chapter in the book, chapter 3, where I do some exploration of the utilization of narrative sources for developing both thickly described examples that can then be engaged with philosophically. So there's an example of that, or some examples of that in the book that we've been talking about, but I'm trying to develop the project further and looking at, say, Hindu mythology, Buddhist mythology, Yoruba, so West African mythological themes, the kind of stories that are told within those cultures and the ways that they can inform us about different aspects of their religion, whether it be religious beliefs or religious practices, or just simply the mythology itself is intrinsically philosophically interesting, raises philosophical questions, and we can try to explore ways of talking about it, discussing it philosophically. So, but not just mythology, but also novels and films and such like. So that's the area of my research that I'm developing further. Currently, it's a long-term project, and I hope that it will evolve into a monograph, into a book, and maybe other publications in due course.
Exciting work ahead. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Mikael, for being here at New Books Network. It's a pleasure having this conversation with you. And also, I believe that the listeners will have gleaned a lot from your work, and also they will grab a hold of your book and then go through it. Yeah. Thank you very much, Dr. Mikael. Yeah.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you very much for your interesting questions.